Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity.
Dr. Ivan Kallous is a lecturer in the Department of English. He's also my neighbor and at the university. I should greet this. He's the editor, together with Stefan Herbrechter of the University of Leeds, of two books on literary theory. So Dr. Kallous is primarily a theorist. His main interest is theory. And these two books will be appearing later this year. The first is called Discipline and Practice, The Resistibility of Theory, that's published by Bucknell University Press. And the second book, which is also out later this year, I believe, is called Post Theory, Culture and Criticism, and that's published by Rodopi. He's also the author of a number of papers on deconstruction, comparative literature, and post-humanism, which is why we're talking about the hectic nature of our schedule before this talk started. He has also been entrusted with the editing of previously unpublished manuscripts, and this is very interesting, by Ferdinand de Saussure. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the extremely high-profile theorist in the field of linguistics. And he's compiling an annotated bibliography of works on Saussure's anagram notebooks, the first part of which appeared in Cahiers, Ferdinand de Saussure, last year. That, I imagine it's a book.
It's a journal which comes out once a year.
Okay, it's a specialist journal.
Yes.
Okay, tonight Dr. Kallous will be talking to us about theorizing in the humanities the post-9/11 period, which is now.
Yes.
Period.
Thanks very much, Mark. just two points I'd like to make before I start. The word philosophy in my title today is perhaps a bit of a misnomer. I won't be speaking about philosophy as such. I'm just taking the word philosophy from Giovanna Boradori's book, Philosophy in a Time of Terror, Dialogues with Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida. And the second thing is that I've had to determine the style of my paper on the basis of integrating many of the quotations from theorists into my own sentences. Now, I cannot spend the whole session with my arms up in the air signaling square quotes, but I'm sure you'll be able to figure out where the theorists' words come in. Okay, here goes. What happens to philosophy in a time of terror? This question might well be regarded as frivolous. After all, we know what must happen to philosophy after September 11. In the aftermath of all that was sprung on the United States and on the world from a clear blue sky on that fateful summer's day, everything has changed. Is not this the mantra that has been repeated in innumerable contexts discussing the event? One must therefore assume that what must happen to philosophy also is change, and a form of adaptation to the circumstances, polarities, idioms, and tonalities that now prevail. Before it becomes even possible to contemplate the nature of that adaptation, however, it might appear important to concede that to worry about what philosophy might be experiencing at the moment is hardly, in fact, very urgent. Are there not objectively more important things to consider, like how to prevent similar attacks from occurring again, or monitoring the progress of the war against terror in Waziristan, or bolstering security around the hotels of Baghdad and throughout the transport infrastructure in Europe, or ensuring that populations are vigilant but not alarmed, or maintaining economic prosperity in the context of jittery markets, or sustaining, so the rhetoric goes, coalitions of the willing while exorcising excesses of evil. Against the momentousness of that backdrop, to worry about what is happening to philosophy in these times seems to be out of touch with everything except the consolations of ivory towers. Let me suggest, however, that the question is in fact not frivolous or self-indulgent. Would it be too glib to recall a singularly auspicious time for philosophy that occurred more than 250 years ago, when it was revolution and afterwards terror with a capital T that later happened to the world? Diderot and Rousseau, we know, helped to start something in the 18th century. We may well disagree about the causality, if any, linking the writings of a group of philosophers and a terror that was as epistemicidal as it was incorruptibly discriminate and indiscriminate in its massacres. But the intuition that the ideational and the political inform each other is fairly repressible. Ever since Aristotle tutored Alexander, indeed, it has probably been commonsensical. One can indeed see why the figure of Rousseau in Shelley's visionary poem The Triumph of Life is so stricken by the thought that what his work gave rise to was not the emancipation of humanity from its chains, but its opposite, in fanning certain political winds. Shelley has Rousseau say, "I have suffered what I wrote, or viler pain, and so my words have seeds of misery, even as the deeds of others, not as theirs." So with all that in the background, we can perhaps ask with a better conscience what it is that that is being said now about philosophy in a time of terror. Yet here we come up against an apparent anomaly. There seems to be a perception abroad that philosophy has not in fact pronounced itself very prominently on September 11 at all. This is incorrect, of course, as all political philosophers will know. Nevertheless, I was brought to realize how strong that perception is when I was asked by somebody what it was that I could possibly talk about today, given the perceived and relative lack of engagement within the humanities generally after September 11, with September 11. I admit that the perception might seem justified, and in fact others over the past days have told me that they are surprised to notice that so much within the humanities appears unattuned to the aftermath of September 11. As I shall try to show, that reading is not quite precise. But I'd like to run with that idea just a little while longer and cite a seemingly striking proof of it. Fallacious in my opinion, but nevertheless striking. The front cover of Time magazine on 10th September 2001 ran a photograph of Colin Powell with the words, "Where have you gone?" Colin Powell. It is perhaps tasteless to remark that wherever he had gone, he came back pretty quickly one day later. But the point is not that. It is rather that much changed on front covers of innumerable magazines and periodicals afterwards, but not, it would seem, on or indeed within the covers of journals pertaining to the humanities. This might appear scandalous, given that even a magazine as famously detached from the non-virtual world as Wired ran a special issue on the topic called "The Future of War is Here." And the idea was, how can we fight a clean technological war without casualties, bloodshed, and so on and so forth? The typical Wired angle. True, some journals in the humanities, like the South Atlantic Quarterly, bugged what might seem an unconscionable trend by running a special number with contributions by people in the humanities. Most other notable journals in the humanities, however, appear to have remained curiously aloof. Angelici and Textual Practice, to mention two notable examples, remain supremely untouched by the whole event. It is in this context that it could appear that the most notable philosophical statement about the events arrives displacedly, extradisciplinarily, that is, not from philosophy, strictly, but in a book by Giovanna Boradori called Philosophy in a Time of Terror, and subtitled Dialogues with Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida. The fact that the question could be seen to arise not from philosophy as such, but from critical theory understood in a very broad sense, to take in both the tradition of the Frankfurt School, with Habermas as its representative, and Derrida as the exponent of critical theory, understood differently, to mean an amalgam of literary and cultural theory, is surely significant. It forces us to suppose that what should be more precisely debated here is the fortunes in the sage of terrorism of what have been called the theoretical humanities. Those comprise what Jonathan Culler has called a miscellaneous genre made up of works of anthropology, art history, film studies, gender studies, literary criticism, linguistics, philosophy, there's a whole list, and which for short I shall be referring to in this paper as theory. What then happens to theory after September 11? Has it changed? Is it changing? Would we know any such change, any change, if we saw it? And how might it be discernible and identifiable? Evidently, the best route to approaching these questions is to read what theorists themselves have had to say about September 11. And here I notice that theorists, contrary to the perception I was speaking about before, have in fact been exceedingly happy and quick, perhaps too quick, to discuss September 11. Indeed, they have been much less coy about the seemliness of doing so than I was in my opening. Perhaps then, and again contrary to the perception I was speaking about earlier, this is one of the most obvious things to have happened to theory after September 11. Its subject matter has evolved. The predominant foci are no longer quite the nature of the postmodern, or the endless argumentation over when it was exactly that postmodernism ended, for instance. No longer so Kellyan debates over the notorious Lacanian statement that the nature of the phallus is equal to the square root of minus one. No longer the longevity spoken of by François Cuisset on the on fringe theory in America. As Virilio wittily put it, there is a suspension now in talk of the death of the author, of the creator, and of the procreator. There is instead increased interest in the political and in the intercultural, insofar as they are impinged upon by the dynamics of contemporary terror. It is impossible in a paper of this length to do justice to all that has been said and written about this in theory. To keep the discussion manageable, I have therefore opted to focus on a fairly narrow but well-defined range of texts within theory. This is composed of Boradori's book, but also by the studies commissioned by the publishers Verso, who asked Jean Baudrillard, Noam Chomsky, Paul Virilio, Slavoj Žižek, and Judith Butler to each produce a slight monograph on September 11. The stated aim, the declared aim of Verso, was to get beyond rent-a-quote punditry. In what follows, I must omit reference to Chomsky's book and to Butler's book. The former because of the very problematic disciplinary relation to theory of Chomsky, and Butler's book because it will only become available in April. I therefore propose in what follows to proceed by first speaking briefly about Baudrillard's and Virilio's take on September 11, then moving on to that of Derrida, Žižek, and Habermas. If that seems a bit too much like a whistle-stop tour, I have to defend myself by saying that I guess what I'm trying to do here is to offer a very general introduction to some of the responses to September 11 within the theoretical humanities. Now, to start with Baudrillard is to expect provocativeness. One remembers the notoriety of the Baudrillardian view that, to cite one of his titles, the Gulf War does not exist. That statement, uttered in reaction to the quasi-virtual way in which the Gulf War of the early 90s was fought by the West, and the belief that zero-sum casualties are possible in modern warfare, appears as woefully inadequate now as the view of Francis Fukuyama, a favorite target for theorists, that we are come to the end of history. That was a view pronounced more than 5 years ago now. In his essay, The Spirit of Terrorism, Baudrillard confronts this apparent comeuppance of his earlier theories, sold on provocativeness. And this is the quote which is in your handout. How do things stand with the real events then, if reality is everywhere infiltrated by images, virtuality and fiction? In the present case, we thought we had seen, perhaps with a certain relief, a resurgence of the real in an allegedly virtual universe. There's an end to your talk about the virtual. This is something real. Similarly, it was possible to see this as a resurgence of history beyond its proclaimed end. But does reality actually outstrip fiction? If it seems to do so, this is because it has absorbed fiction's energy. We can almost say, says Baudrillard, that reality is jealous of fiction, that the real is jealous of the image. It is a kind of duel between them, a contest to see which can be the most unimaginable. This is almost convincing. There is some cogency, of course, but we need to remember that what Baudrillard is trying to do is to update his views on simulation and simulacra, those mainstays of postmodernist thought, for theory after September 11. And what Baudrillard says is, in fact, cogent to a degree. He observes that when we come to symbolic events on a grand scale, we had had none. The last great event he mentions on this scale, and it's of course not on the same order, is the death of Diana. As the Argentinian writer Macedonia Fernandez put it, says Baudrillard, events were on strike. Well, the strike is over now. September 11 seems to be the absolute event which, and this might be regarded as the first overt statement on the implications for theory, for philosophy, well, this absolute event disrupts the conditions of analysis, he says. He adds, while events were stagnating, you had to anticipate and move more quickly than they did. But when they speed up this much, you have to move more slowly. With exemplary slowness, Baudrillard's analysis moves through the implications of September 11. Rewriting Clausewitz, he makes acute points about the West's fight against terror being tantamount to war as continuation of the absence of politics and political ideology by other means, and speaks elsewhere of how the spectacle of terrorism forces the terrorism of spectacle upon us. And against this immoral fascination, the political order can do nothing. This, says Baudrillard, is our theater of cruelty, the only one we have left. That stages itself amidst the aftermath of September 11, which redimensionalizes the contrast between virtuality or hyperreality and reality, doing so most concretizingly in the exclamation we all know, it's also like a movie. He says, and this is the second quote in your handout, in this case, then, the real is superadded to the image like a bonus of terror, like an additional frisson. Not only is it terrifying, but what is more, it is real. Rather than the violence of the real being there first, and the frisson of the image being added to it, the image is there first, and the frisson of the real is added. This accords with Baudrillard's view that terrorist violence is not a blowback of reality, merely. And a singular event, he says, in this Manhattan disaster movie, the 20th century's two elements of mass fascination are combined, the white magic of the cinema and the black magic of terrorism. For, as he points out, the terrorists exploited the real time of images, their instantaneous worldwide presentation, such that the media are part of the event, they are part of the terror, and they work in both directions. Broadly speaking, this is the same view that Paul Virilio takes on September 11 in his book Ground Zero. Virilio remarks on the relevance to our times of what he calls telecracy. This arises in the age of, again his term, a chronopolitics of instantaneity, replacing parliamentary geopolitics, where what occurs is at best a ludic democracy for infantilized telecitizens, again his phrase. And what this democracy watched in September 11 was, according to Virilio, the perfectly orchestrated image strategy of the terrorist attacks, and beyond that, the frightening implications of the fact that we are always one war behind. For Virilio, when George W. Bush declared that his country was the champion of good, and that the battle against terrorism would be a monumental struggle of good versus evil, and good will prevail, he was speaking the same language as his father in 1991, itself copied from the language of the just war fought by the United States against Nazism a century before. Virilio has it that the stark fact is that there are not yet any experts in global terrorist warfare, not even among the terrorists. And what transpires for him is that we find ourselves facing an unprecedented situation, since it is one which is globally suicidal. I'd like to foreground this notion of the global suicidal state. The reason is that it is an idea that theorists commenting on September 11 return to compulsively, and one they write about with great earnestness. Zizek, for instance, suggests that the US is fighting its own nexus in this war. Baudrillard, to return to him for a moment, remarks that what September 11 signals is that the West has become suicidal and declared war on itself. By seizing all the cards for itself, he says, it forced the other to change the rules, one other element, it could be said, of the everything that has changed. Suicidally, therefore, the West brought about a change in the mode with which its adversaries might attack it. The change comes across most strongly in the realization that the terrorists are, in Baudrillard's words, not fighting fair because they put their own debts into play. Or, in the words of one much publicized but still to be authenticated letter after the recent Madrid bombings, they prefer death, contrary to those against whom they range themselves, who prefer life. Zizek's, Baudrillard's and Virilio's positions are important because they set the tone for what Derrida calls the logic of autoimmunity, in his essay on September 11 called Autoimmunity, Real and Symbolic Suicides. In writing on September 11, Derrida revitalizes the idea of autoimmunity that he had written about in an earlier work, Faith and Knowledge, the Two Sources of Religion and the Limits of Reason Alone. According to the idea of the logic of autoimmunity, a living being, in quasi-suicidal fashion, itself works to destroy its own protection, to immunize itself against its own immunity. I quote from Derrida, and this is the next quote in the handout. Here is the first symptom of suicidal autoimmunity. The aggression of which it is the object comes as from the inside, from forces that are apparently without any force of their own, but that are able to find the means, through ruse and the implementation of high-tech knowledge, to get hold of an American weapon in an American city on the ground of an American airport. These hijackers incorporate, so to speak, two suicides in one, their own, but also the suicide of those who welcomed, armed, and trained them. For let us not forget that the United States had in effect paved the way for and consolidated the forces of the adversary by training people like Bin Laden, and by first of all creating the politico-military circumstances that would further their emergence and their shifts in allegiance. And further, the next quote, all efforts to attenuate or neutralize the effect of the traumatism are but so many desperate attempts, and so many autoimmunitory movements, which produce, invent, and feed the very monstrosity they claim to overcome. What will never let itself be forgotten is thus the perverse effect of the autoimmunitory itself. For we now know that repression in both its political and psychoanalytical sense ends up producing, reproducing, and regenerating the very thing it seeks to disarm. I am struck by this deployment of the autoimmunity metaphor, not least because it is succinctly effective. Additionally, the metaphor where the viral metaphor recurs across contexts. Baudrillard, for instance, says that terrorism, like viruses, is everywhere, as indicated by what he terms its height of cunning, which involved using the banality of American everyday life as cover and camouflage, such that any inoffensive person can be a potential terrorist. But while that is deeply interesting, I'd like to draw attention away from it to focus on something in Derrida's reflections on autoimmunity that is more intimately linked to the specific theme of my talk today, that is, to what happens to the theoretical humanities after September 11. For what happens to theory after September 11 is surely not merely that it changes because it has to write about the evolving world situation, but that it itself is changed tonally and perspectivally by what has happened. And that, one would think, might be the more interesting concern. Derrida addresses that issue directly in autoimmunity, in answer to a question by Giovanna Boradori that asks, what role do you see for philosophy? Can philosophy help us understand what happened? Before I relate his answer, let me suggest that it is probably reasonable to assume that if philosophy has a role, it is to help us understand the events of September 11 more penetratingly and with greater insight than homespun or commonplace thinking. Otherwise, why bother? Derrida acknowledges as much, lamenting that the response in the media and in the official rhetoric relies too much on received concepts. He is also definite in asserting that such an event clearly calls for a philosophical response, one that calls into question, his words, at their most fundamental level, the most deep-seated conceptual presuppositions in philosophical discourse. And this he converges with Habermas, who, asked whether the intellectual can play a role in our particular context, calls for a related shift. However, Habermas responds also by indicating some wearisomeness with what has been said so far on September 11 in theory, and that because theory has not in fact changed or caused a change in the discourse with which September 11 is discussed, or not as stringently as he would have liked. The usual suspects, he says, who speak out on other occasions, have done so this time too. There have been the usual pros and cons, the same snarl of voices with the familiar national differences in style and public resonance. Consequently, when Derrida points to the urgency of a refoundation of the juridico-political and a conceptual mutation at once semantic, lexical, and rhetorical, it is not at all clear to Habermas that this is in fact occurring, that theory is responding to the challenges of September 11. Should it? At a practical level, it probably should. There is no doubt, for instance, that one of the much-hyped events in the theoretical humanities, the publication of Empire by Negri and Hart, would probably be more justified if it were to factor in any second edition considerations relating to September 11. The study of post-colonialism, for instance, seems to call for redimensionalization. It would seem blinkered, even unconscionable, for any aspect of the theoretical humanities to go on as if nothing had happened. As a way of indicating by means of an example why such change is both desirable and traceable, I'd like to focus here for a little while longer on autoimmunity, the reason Derrida's essay that is, the reason being that to my mind it spells a distinct shift in Derrida's thought and the tonalities of his discourse on politics. The stakes in this are clearly appreciable. If Derrida's habits of thought and expression can be shown to have been transformed as a result of the events of September 11, that, as a result of his preeminence within the theoretical humanities, becomes something of an event in its own right. At any rate, something to make us sit up and attend to a change in the rhetoric of theory. I'd like to show that what this change involves is an indulgence by Derrida in his writing on September 11 of an apocalyptic tone. This, not to put too fine a point upon it, is a real turn-up for the books. The reason, of course, is that Derrida has in the past been rather scornful of what Stuart Sim calls endism. In other words, of apocalypticism in the writing of philosophy and theory. The essays by Derrida which leap to mind as vehicles of that disaffection are The Ends of Man, 1972, Of a Newly Arisen Apocalyptic Tone in Philosophy, 1981, No Apocalypse, Not Now, 1984, and Some Statements and Truisms About Neologisms, Newisms, Postisms, Parasitisms, and Other Small Seismisms, 1990. In all these essays, Derrida had scorned the easy indulgence and excitable talk of imminent ends. But that scorn can also be found elsewhere. In an early passage, Inspectors of Marx, for instance, Jacques Derrida comments with some asperity about the many young people of today who no longer sufficiently realize that the eschatological themes of the end of history, of the end of Marxism, of the end of philosophy, of the ends of man, of the last man, and so forth, were in the 50s our daily bread. Been there, done that, is what he's saying. This bread of apocalypse, or the apocalyptic tone in philosophy, was, according to Derrida, the result of an immersion in classics of the end of his generation. And the canon of the modern apocalypse, and of history, and of men, and of philosophy, Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche, Heidegger, as well as the result of an engagement with the historical entanglement involving, among other issues, these are issues he cites, Stalinism and Hungary. Derrida concludes, "For those with whom I shared the singular period, for us, I venture to say, the media parade of current discourse on the end of history and the last man looks most often like a tiresome anachronism. As for those who abandon themselves to that discourse with the jubilation of youthful enthusiasm, they look like latecomers." In the context of that statement, one would not expect Derrida, even after September 11, to have much truck with endism. And yet, that there might have been arising gradually a newly apprehensive tone in deconstruction is detectable even in No Apocalypse, Not Now. In a very curious sequence in that essay, Derrida admitted that philosophical ingeniousness is all very well, but that it cannot safeguard the philosopher from generally assured extermination. Turning in that essay to consider the possibility of whether there was or was not a radically new predicate in the situation known as the nuclear age, which he characterized as one underpinned by dramatic acceleration and therefore a need of critical slowdown, he conceded. But this dissuasion and deceleration I am urging carry their own risks. The critical zeal that leads us to recognize precedents, continuities, and repetitions at every turn can make us look like suicidal sleepwalkers, blind and deaf alongside the unheard of. And further, he says, one may still die after having spent one's life recognizing, as a lucid historian, to what extent all that was not new, telling oneself that the inventors of the nuclear age or of nuclear criticism did not invent the wheel. That's the way one always dies, he says, and the death of what is still now and then called humanity might well not escape the rule. An acknowledgement from him, then, that one would look pretty silly, dying in the apocalyptic moment, while one is still in eloquent, philosophical, critical, and historical denial of the apocalypse. Why is this analogically important when assessing Derrida's response to September 11? If anything, his querulousness concerning thoughts of ruptures or breaks is an important corrective to dramatic overreactions to September 11, of which there have been many. The thing is, however, that receptivity to a possibly newly arisen apprehensive tone in Derrida's philosophy allows one to pick up on a move beyond such querulousness, a move occasioned, arguably but also demonstrably, as I shall try to show, by September 11. In this, I am not trying to turn the lessons of Derrida's essay against him. I am, however, trying to be attentive to what might be at stake in alleging a change in tone in his work, doing so in full awareness of the lessons of this passage which I am going to quote, and which is absolutely crucial to what I am discussing here. It's the next passage in the quotation. The attention to tone, Derrida says, which is not just style, seems rare to me. Tone has been little studied for itself, if we suppose that it is possible or has ever been done. A tone's distinctive signs are difficult to isolate, if they even exist in complete purity, which I doubt, above all in a written discourse. By what is a tone marked, a change or a rupture in tone? And how do you recognize a tonal difference within the same corpus? This is the crucial question. How do you recognize a tonal difference within the same corpus? What traits are to be trusted for analyzing this? What signposting? Neither stylistic nor rhetorical, nor evidently thematic or semantic. The extreme difficulty of this question, indeed of this task, becomes more accentuated in the case of philosophy. Isn't the dream or the ideal of philosophical discourse, of philosophical address, and of the writing supposed to represent that address, isn't it to make tonal difference inaudible, and with it a whole desire, effect, or scene that works over the concept in contraband? Through what is called neutrality of tone, philosophical discourse must also guarantee the neutrality, or at least the imperturbable serenity that should accompany the relation to the true and the universal, says the Ridavari tonally. This is intimidating, all the more so because there is a context to it. When writing this, Derrida was commenting on Kant's pamphlet on a newly arisen superior tone in philosophy, which constituted an attack on a tone that denounces something like the death of philosophy, that's Kant, and in which Kant was taking issue with what Derrida calls the transgression of the atonal norm of philosophical address. The passage intimates just how difficult it will be here to establish that there is demonstrably a certain change or rupture in tone in Derrida's oeuvre, and how inscrutable and elusive the resources for doing that must be. For how to assert that there is a change in tone in the work of the very philosopher Derrida, who explains how difficult it is to identify such a change in anything cur's oeuvre? I hope that I am not mad in attempting this, and the attempt proceeds in the fuller version of this essay, which I cannot present here. What I can do, however, is to allude again to the autoimmunity essay. The new tonality of Derrida's discourse might usefully and succinctly be demonstrated by drawing attention to the frequency with which one word, bad, the word bad, recurs in that essay. It does so most often in the form of the comparative and the superlative of bad, worse and worst, the words worse and worst. Borador's otherwise excellent commentaries on her dialogues with Habermas and Derrida overlook this really rather remarkable feature and its implications for an understanding of how even Derrida is doing apocalypse now. Here, before I probe this issue further, are some examples of the incidence of worse or worst in Derrida's essay, the essay on September 11, and it's the next quote. So, first sentence. At issue again is what, when seen from the capital, might be worse than the Cold War. So September 11 is worse than the Cold War. Next one. Or at least, if it is the present or the past, it is only insofar as it bears on its body the terrible sign of what might or perhaps will take place, which will be worse than anything that has ever taken place. Next one. Traumatism is produced by the future, by the to come, by the threat of the worst to come, rather than by the aggression that it is over and done with. Next. But, and here's another paradox, even if this terror is the very worst, even if it touches the geopolitical unconscious of every living being and leaves their indelible traces, because of the anonymous invisibility of the enemy, because of the undetermined origin of the terror, the worst can simultaneously appear insubstantial, fleeting, light, and so seem to be denied, repressed, indeed forgotten, relegated to being just one event among others, one of the major events in a long chain of past and future events. Next one. One will be able to do even worse tomorrow, invisibly, in silence, more quickly, and without any bloodshed, by attacking the computer and informational networks on which the entire life of a great nation, of the greatest power on earth, depends. And lastly, we thus deny the irresistible foreboding that the worst has not taken place, not yet. I have not inventorized here all instances of the words worse or worse in philosophy in a time of terror. In fact, I am keeping in reserve reference to one other. That said, it is striking that worse and worst clearly recur more frequently in Derrida's text than in those of Habermas or Boradori. This is all of a piece with the unwavering, uncompromising focus of Derrida on just how apocalyptically bad the aftermath of September 11 could conceivably turn out to be. For there could be little that is worse than the apocalypse. Hence, Derrida durst to express this unthinkable and this incalculable event, inevitably deploying a further mention of worse. And he says, I think it's in your sheets, one day, it might be said, September 11, those were the good old days of the last war. Things were still of the order of the gigantic, visible and enormous. What size, what height? There has been worse since. Nanotechnologies of all sorts are so much more powerful and invisible, uncontrollable, capable of creeping in everywhere. They are the micrological rivals of microbes and bacteria. Yet our unconscious is already aware of this. It already knows it, and that's what's scary. The prospect is sufficiently disturbing to induce Derrida to denounce and to take sides. This is Derrida taking sides, a very unusual spectacle. And he says, what appears to me unacceptable in the strategy of the Bin Laden effect is, above all, the fact that such actions and discourses open onto no future, and in my view, have no future. If we are to put any faith in the perfectibility of public space and of the world juridico-political scene of the world itself, then there is, it seems to me, nothing good to be hoped for from that quarter. That is why, in this unleashing of violence without name, if I had to take one of the two sides and choose in a binary situation, well, I would. I would take the side of the camp that, in principle, by right of law, leaves a perspective open to perfectibility in the name of the political, democracy, international law, international institutions, and so on. The amazing thing here is that he's actually sounding like Habermas. I don't hear any such promise coming from Bin Laden, at least not one for this world. Strong words from the arch-deconstructor of binary oppositions and a significant choice between binary opposites. It is a choice understandable in terms of the apocalypse being that which by definition leaves no future. And in this sense, the Bin Laden effect, which opens onto no future, is the very figure of the apocalyptic. But of course, what is telling here is the newly urgent tone in Derrida's idiom. It is earnest, it is committed, it is grave. What is ultimately noteworthy, therefore, is the readiness with which it is suggested by Derrida that at a time when September 11 is clearly the contemporary counterpart to the events called Stalin or Hungary that were mentioned in Spectres of Marx, circumspection now is no option. The contrast with another Derrida, an earlier Derrida, who admitted in an 80s interview to not having been a 68er, one of the protesters of 68, because of his aversion to, in his words, vibrating in unison, will not be lost upon those who have followed the development of his work. More so, since in the same context, there is the further suggestion that one of our first responsibilities is to analyze the emergence of what is new and unprecedented, his words. And, again his words, only by rigorously taking into account this novelty will we be able to adjust our responses and our acts of resistance, and also, one might add, our tonalities. It would appear, therefore, that even without launching into more extended comparative analysis on the differences between Derrida's earlier and later work, there is in his essays what Derrida himself calls a new criteriology. A new criteriology. The new criteriology arises because in Derrida's view, a view unprecedentedly open to the apocalyptic, what is put at risk by this terrifying autoimmunitary logic is nothing less than the existence of the world, of the worldwide itself. A grim scenario brings this point starkly home. It is by no means certain that humanity will grow quite as blasé about the banality of the end, as it had grown inured through what Herman Rapaport and Maurice Blanchot respectively call thanatopraxie and the various resources of the writing of the disaster to Cold War menaces. There is Hannah Arendt in the background here, of course. Quite simply, that is because it is possible to do the apocalypse more inventively now. And through all the inventions that have made previous technologies of the end obsolete, and that will continue in a paradoxical renewing of the ends to do so. This, in fact, is itself a sign of the apocalyptic newness of the now. Previous apocalyptic technologies have been obliterated by an accelerated logic of obsolescence, almost as if previous generations seem datedly exterminable, while we appear to be available to more designedly state-of-the-art, indeed practically designer endings, which, and this is where terror comes in, are potentially procurable by those undeterred by any detente. Consequently, the worst is not merely thinkable, but apprehensible as something on this side of improbability. In that apprehending, the theoretical humanities seem to lack le bon ton, a proper tone, if they ignore the new realities and the new criteriology they institute. If I overstate or overdramatize, it is with a purpose. I want to bring to stark definition the realization that after September 11, talk of the apocalyptic can no longer seem, as it may have done to Derrida in a peaked moment in Spectres of Marx, the excitable futurological prattle of latecomers. This is something that Virilio, who states that we're on the road at best to dystopia and at worst to what he calls Uchronia, the time of no time, shares. So does Baudrillard. He speaks of the fact that there is talk of bioterrorism, bacteriological warfare, or nuclear terrorism, such that the possibility is of annihilation, pure and simple, of the order of the final solution. And Zizek shares it too. Zizek, in his book Welcome to the Desert of the Real, the title significantly taken from a line in The Matrix, that film precariously balanced on the line dividing the real from the virtual, the perceptual from the perceptible, and survival from apocalypse, well, Zizek proceeds by making a number of points which echo Baudrillard, Virilio, and Derrida. Thus he refers to Alain Badiou's view that the 20th century is characterized by a passion for the real, and shares the view that reality, however mediatized, erupted on September 11 to make a mockery of the supposed paradigm of the virtual. But for Zizek, the real which returns has, in his words, the status of another semblance, precisely because it is real, that is, on account of its traumatic and excessive character, we are unable to integrate it with our reality, and are therefore compelled to experience it as a nightmarish apparition. To me, this recalls Baudrillard's assertion that the tactic of the terrorist model is to bring about an excess of reality, and have the system collapse beneath that excess. Indeed, Zizek moves to correct Badiou. The problem with the 20th century passion for the real, he says, was not that it was a passion for the real, but that it was a fake passion, whose ruthless pursuit of the real behind appearances was the ultimate stratagem to avoid confronting the real. But the real returns with a vengeance, as Zizek's own apocalyptic words indicate. The World Trade Center Twin Towers explosion and collapse in September 2001 were, he says, the last spectacular cry of 20th century warfare. What awaits is something much more uncanny, the specter of an immaterial war where the attack is invisible, viruses, poisons which can be everywhere and nowhere. On the level of visible material reality, nothing happens, no big explosions. Yet the known universe starts to collapse, he says, and life to disintegrate.